And welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast which is about board games. Very surprising. Now, we didn't have a show last week, and Mark graciously, you know, stepped under the bus for that one, but I think it was pretty well my fault. I was doing a lot of moving and was very busy, so I do apologize for that. That being said, we are going to be going into our summer schedule this week.
So we have good news and bad news. The bad news is, yes, we are going back to summer schedule for a variety of reasons past anyone's interest, much less yours. But we've figured out a way, we think, to maintain the summer schedule so as to allow us to continue doing it without taking any weeks off. If you'll recall, last year we went to a once every 2 week schedule, but we're not going to be doing that going forward. What we're going to do now is every other week we're going to do a game review in depth. We're going to have a feature game, and every other week we're going to have a topic. So this week is the start of our summer schedule, and we're going to have the Aurus, our as yet unnamed retrospective intro segment, the games we played last week, the news, why it doesn't matter, no feature game. And we're going to have our topic, and our topic this week is good games that induce pain. And next week, we're also going to have an episode, but we're going to just do games we played last week, the news and why it doesn't matter, and our feature game. So this is going to carry us through to the summer months, and we hope that you accept the fact that you'll be getting about as much swag as you did before, although slightly parceled out. So this is the compromise we've come up. Please feel free to send any complaints to the typical source at Air Canada. I'm sure they're very, very keen to talk about board games, as they always are. And we hope that you understand that this is what we've come up with, and that this is what we... Maybe I should just keep circling around and saying the same thing, three things over.
Yeah.
Just
yeah. One more time.
One more time?
About the second time. So
this is what you're going to get, and we hope you like it.
So the game we reviewed last year, Mark, was Mage Knight. Now, since then, they've come out with this giant box of Mage Knight where you can get all the expansions and the base game all in one box to make it even that much more exciting, and I still have not played it. That's not to say that Mage Knight isn't a great game, because it is a great game, but... I just think that the game, other games that are coming out now do just as much as Mage Knight did and have a lot less rules overhang and a lot easier to teach and a lot easier to set up and go.
It's funny that you say that because I actually think the opposite is true. We've spent a lot of time over the course of the past year talking about various adventure-y type games, right? Whether you want to include things that are slightly further afield, things like Crisis at Steamfall, whether you want to talk about things like City of Kings, whether you want to talk about lots of other things like that. And I honestly think that in terms of where it's situated in the genre, Mage Knight still holds its place as the king of what it's trying to do, which is to say a meaty, gamerly game about overland adventure and combat. And all the other times that I played the other contenders to the throne, I've really been feeling that either I wanted to do something that was just about fighting, something a little bit more like Too Many Bones or Street Masters or something along those lines, or something that was more substantial like Mage Knight. And yes, it is absolutely the case that in terms of setup and in terms of rules overhead, it's considerable. In terms of playing time, it's nothing to sneeze at. I've still made the effort to pull it out in the year since we've reviewed. It's not something I play all the time, but it is absolutely something that I appreciate. I haven't tried the new Ultimate Edition, but whatever, I have all the components anyway, except for the five additional cards they put out. And you can buy those separately from WizKids, so good on them for making that available. But every time I see someone talking about how, you know, how is Mage Knight held up? Has it aged? And people say, oh, well, you know, it feels awfully clunky. It's always felt reasonably clunky, you know, and I say that as someone who loves the game. But I really do think that Mage Knight still is the king of what it's trying to do.
Yeah, for deck building, so I think it's very close to a Gloomhaven, though, when you think about it. It's like a hand management, deck building, you know, adventure game. And I'd really much rather play Gloomhaven than Mage Knight, but... For like a solo play or just the artwork alone and just the way it works, it is still, like you said, it's still holding up and I still enjoy it, even though I haven't played it.
The comparison to Gloomhaven, I think, is an illustrative one. I think that Gloomhaven is a better game, but in terms of rules overhead, I don't think that there's substantially less. There is less. Gloomhaven is a more approachable game rules-wise, but I don't think that the difference is considerable. And in terms of setup and overall administrative overhead, I really do think that Mage Knight is better because the sheer amount of components you need to wrestle in an average game of Gloomhaven is really, really high, even higher than that of Mage Knight. And in Gloomhaven, you have to deal with the additional campaign stuff. And maybe I'm alone in really, you know, finding the campaign stuff to be more of a burden than a benefit. It, although with the possible exception of in context like Gloomhaven. But it's weird. I think that my appreciation for Mage Knight has only gone up, and yours seems to be a little bit on the wane. So
agreed.
So that's what we reviewed last year. Let's talk about the games we played last week. I had a good week of playing games that we've reviewed in the past. I had a great game of Street Masters, a great game of Pandemic Fall of Rome, great game of Cerebria. Those are all three games that we've had feature games. By the way, those are episodes 32, 51, and 57, respectively, for those that want to go through our excellent back catalog. Another game that I got to play again, I talked about this briefly, was Imperius, and talked about how it was a drafting and sort of area control-ish type game, which on first play seemed very, very, very random. And I was curious to see if it was going to feel a little bit more substantial and a little bit more deterministic on subsequent plays. I played it again with three this time. An interesting thing about Imperius is among its fans, there's no strong consensus about what number at which it's best. It plays at 2, 3, and 4. And I have found people defend each of those player counts as being the ideal way to play Imperius. The first time we played it was with 4, which certainly does seem to be a way to maximize the chaos and of the uncertainty of what's going on. With 3 and at a second playing, and I think it's a little bit of both that contributed to this, I enjoyed it substantially more. It's still pretty crazy. The other two people were new players. I didn't play it with Walker because I decided to have a good time this time. And they seemed to think that it was a lot more deterministic than the other people we played with the first time. So suffice to say that Imperius is something that I am going to make the effort to try to see its depth. I'm going to play it a couple more times at least, probably, and you would express some interest in playing it again. And for a 20-minute game, you know, even if it's completely arbitrary, I'm willing to forgive a game 20 minutes if it turns out to be completely arbitrary. And I do find it awfully visually appealing. And as I commented before, sometimes you get these glimpses of these clever plays where you're not sure if it's a clever play or if it's just something that happened randomly. And if it's the case that those clever plays are actually possible under controlled conditions, then we might be talking about one of the best fillers that I've played in the past 5 years. So I'm very curious to see if that manifests. And that has been my further experience with Imperius.
Finally got Baron Park to the table after almost 2 years of not playing it. I played it, you know, back at UK Games Expo a long time ago in Bethlehem.
And you played it with the designer Uwe Rosenberg, right?
Yes, I played it with Uwe. It was a great time.
Sorry, this is...
And then he put it out under a ghost name for some reason. I don't understand why he put it under a fake name.
No,
maybe he didn't think it was going to do well. I don't know.
It was an honor to you. He put it under the name Walker Harding.
Ah.
As a testament both to your excellent name and your pecs.
He had such a good time, I guess, yeah.
Sorry, this is an inside joke. One of our early mistakes at Sorry Wrong About Games is we misattributed Baron Park to Uwe Rosenberg. It was not designed by Uwe Rosenberg. It was designed by Philip Walker Harding, so there you go.
I don't know how we made that mistake. Anyway, I don't know why I didn't play with the achievements, because when I played the first time we had the achievements, it definitely will add to the game. Playing it just straight up is a very, entryway game, very basic. Definitely, if you're going to play Baron Park, play with the advanced rules. But other than that, I think it's a great game, easy to teach. It was a 2-page rule book. You're placing tiles, making a cool little Tetris shapes, you know, getting more. There is definitely options there, like choices to make. It's not as though it's just, you know, place a tile anywhere you want. You can look ahead, see that will fit, pick the ones you need. Like skip your turn of placing the ideal piece to get, because you can see one that's about to disappear, stuff like that. What do you think of Baron Park, Mark?
I was pleasantly surprised. I wasn't expecting a whole heck of a lot, and I was very pleased with what it delivered. You're absolutely right that there are substantial trade-offs to be made, both in terms of tempo and in terms of placement. One of the things that Baron Park does as a very, very simple tile-laying game is it does interesting things with your tile supply. Most of the time with these simple tile-laying games, you draw a tile or you draw some number of tiles and you place them. But with Baron Park, the key is to get the tiles that you want to place. And that is where it primarily introduces player interaction, because it's not one of those tiling games where you share the field. You all have your own little bear parks. Why they're bear parks, I don't know. If you're going to have bear parks, at least have the possibility of the bears escaping and eating somebody. Yes, I know that's terribly un-PC for all the defenders of bears and the wildlife, but whatever. I've watched enough Stephen Colbert to know that bears are godless killing machines. And I just, you know, I played Dinosaur Island, and the one thing that Dinosaur Island got right was the possibility of the things you're going to gawk at escaping and murdering everybody. Granted, it was unreasonable for me to want that at Baron Park. But setting all that aside, it's cute, it's nice, and the fact that you have to deliberately go after certain tiles to place in competition with other people, I thought was really neat. I don't know anything about the achievements because I haven't played with them, but I'm glad that after hearing about this game forever that it turned out to be not a snooze fest.
And that's Baron Park.
played a game called Burning Suns. Now, in the context of false advertising, I was very disappointed to see that Burning Suns was not, in point of fact, a game about pyrotechnic family discipline.
Is it about orcs?
No,
it was. Space orcs?
No, there were no space orcs.
Oh.
Close, though. There were space devils. Is that close enough?
Close enough.
Yeah. Burning Suns is a 4X game that was kickstarted in 2013, and fulfillment is not completed. So that just goes to show you what's going on there. I got my copy in trade with somebody, and I actually inquired on BoardGameGeek about whether some of the extra components would be available for sale later on, and some people very gently pointed out to me, it's like, there is no later on yet, Bigney. Later on is a ways off. It's like, ooh, this is embarrassing. Yeah. That having been said, it is in some ways it's very much a first-time Kickstarter design. A lot of the components in terms of the graphic design especially look a little amateurish. The cover looks like something out of a 1990s PS1 game. And there are a number of details about the game that are less usable than they could be. But I will say, I had been prepared for a lot of the failings of a standard 4X genre, overlong, tons and tons of rules questions, especially because there are complaints a mile long on BoardGameGeek about the rules. I found the rules pretty tight, honestly, all things considered. I don't know, maybe we just got lucky and didn't get the weird stuff. And it was a reasonably quick experience, too. We played with four first-time players and, set up, rules explanation, teardown. It was less than 2 hours. And I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty good. In terms of the super stripped-down 4X games, we've talked about Warp Gate and we've talked about Quantum. Those are excellent games that you can finish in an hour-ish. And Eclipse is still probably my favorite of the 4X genre, but, there we're talking about 3 hours and lots of components at least. But Burning Suns, in terms of the middle, the sort of middle-range game, it and Empires of the Void with Key to the Universe are pretty much the only 2-hour-ish 4X-y games that I thought were reasonably satisfying in that era. The key hook to Burning Suns is that you have a framework, a race, and sort of an ideology. So you have these three modular things, and so the asymmetry, the possible combinatorics going on there are huge. It's like Small World on steroids. And it leads to some very interesting asymmetries. Like, these people can't really do diplomacy, but don't get into a fight with them, and they have these weird powers. And I liked it. I like playing with toys in the context of 4X games, and if you're able to do that without overloading the system too much, I think that there's a lot there. So I don't think it's going to set the world on fire, no pun intended, but I really enjoyed my time with Burning Suns, and I'm looking forward to trying it again. Graphic problems notwithstanding, and the fact that some of the components are a bit off. But it is the case that you do have in the core box five different complete sculpts of ships, which is nothing to sneer at. And the key visual appeal for me was that you have these special ships that hold dice, and the dice indicate the hit points, and they just slot into the ships themselves. And that's awfully cute, and it is as fun as I wanted it to be. So that was my experience with Burning Suns, and I'm hoping to get it to the table again soon.
Then we got Downfall Deluxified TM to the table.
Oh, I just threw up a little in my mouth.
It's okay, Mark. It was okay. It wasn't that bad. Well, that being said,
it's the word primarily.
It really was. So it's a post-apocalyptic, put your workers out, collect resources, try to spread out as fastly. It's Canadian, in case you didn't know.
That's no. You act fastly after the process of fastification.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
When you're really hungry. So you try to expand extremely quickly while still trying to feed all your workers and fight over resources. I'm looking forward to playing it again. I'm sure we're going to have a lot more to talk about it later when we've tried it a few more times. A lot of the components are very interesting and very deluxified.
That you're being too charitable, Walker. Say what you really mean.
Overly deluxified and unusable?
Yes. We were playing with, just as one example, we were playing with the expanded map, the oversized map tiles. And even then, we were running out of room on the map tiles to do basic things like have a worker collect some resources.
Yeah, I have no idea. Like, if the regular version has small tiles, I have no idea how you would play.
Yeah, it seems like a nightmare.
So that's Downfall. What do you have anything to add other than the tiny tiles?
Well, we didn't even finish our
we didn't even finish
our first game because it was a slog. Now, and I can't even really fault anyone for playing too slowly. There's a fair amount of simultaneous action, which goes to show you how little player interaction there often is. And it was mostly just a question of how do I get enough food to feed my workers. And I don't mind games that have a strong pressure like that, like Agricola, for example. And indeed, I'm going to talk about games like that later on in our topic. But it it felt more like busy work to me than anything else. Now, maybe the end game is where everything comes alive, or maybe if you just play aggressively, everyone starts having more fun. But, I mean, quite frankly, I can't see a sort of survival game where lots of people can starve to death is improved when some angry jerk next door is coming over and stealing all your stuff. But, yeah, we're going to try it again. We're going to come back with more mature, seasoned, emulsified, and perhaps fermented opinions. But initial impressions were not particularly positive.
And that's downfall.
That's downfall.
Deluxify.
Please stop saying that word.
TM. By TMG Games.
Played Adrenaline with the Team Play DLC. So Adrenaline is a game that is nominally kind of supposed to be a first-person shooter game, but it's actually just an area majority game, which is fine by me. I love area majority games. And here, instead of controlling over areas, you're just doing damage to people. So the areas that you're trying to influence a majority are moving around, and you're moving around doing all these things. The problem is Adrenaline never really clicked for me because it always felt a little bit more procedural and dry than the sort of over-the-top hyperbolic action that it's supposed to parody. And the guns themselves are all different, which is nice, but the iconography is, for my abilities, impossible to parse. You have to make reference to the reference sheet to figure out how the guns operate on a basic level, and so you're always passing around these references, and that kind of sucks people out of the game to a certain extent. The Team Play DLC adds asymmetric character powers and character unique guns, which are kind of cute, but again, more things to look up. But it's nice to have a little bit of asymmetry. But Adrenaline just isn't for me. I like it. It's mechanically sound. I like everything that it does, and as far as area majority games, it's not particularly offensive, and it's a genre that I like, but I don't find it nearly engaging enough, and I think part of it is just the difficulty in interacting with the base elements of the guns and the various mechanics. Now, maybe if I played it all the time, this isn't a question like Imperius, where maybe a couple other times and I'll see it go. It's just there are so many different weapons, which is one of the game's strengths, but it prevents me from being able to really engage with things on a visceral level, and quite frankly, when I'm playing a game of El Grande, I'm not one of the people who thinks, oh gee, maybe this game needs more player interaction, because that's a complete misnomer. El Grande is already a knives-out bash fest. With far more direct competition than even games like, for example, Downfall. And so I don't find that the shift to something like Adrenaline really benefits. So while I'm perfectly willing to play it again if somebody puts it in front of my face, I don't think I'm going to be seeking it out, and that's my opinion of Adrenaline.
Now, on the topic of dry and procedural, let's talk about Pandemic Fall of Rome and what I think I'm feeling about most Pandemic games nowadays.
Oh, no.
It's just dry and procedural. It's like, okay, now we need to trade for this card, now we need to cure that, and then we're done. That's just what it felt. It's like just same. It felt like same old, same old. It's like, okay, now we need to get somewhere to get a card, now we need to do this, now there seems, you know what I mean? It just seemed as though we're just going through the paces of a normal Pandemic game as per usual. Not that it was fun to do, but it started to feel as though it was the same old, same old.
Oh, that's too bad. I really love Fall of Rome. I stand by everything we said in the review. I think that in terms of the way the barbarians move around the map, the way that legions are implicated, I really do think it's a shot in the arm to the formula, and it breaks up the sort of same spatial oddness that a lot of core pandemics have, where just diseases pop up in various random cities and you're always playing whack-a-mole. I really do like the sense of spreading fronts and having to build fortifications and care about the borders and all those other things. And yes, absolutely, I do agree with you that fundamentally games of Pandemic are about killing time until you draw the cards you need, and then deciding how inefficient you want to be in terms of transferring those cards around. But I think that the better versions of Pandemic do a good job of making you forget that that's what's going on. And I really do think that Fall of Rome does a really good job
for
of that.
For sure. If I had to play any Pandemic, it would definitely be Fall of Rome every time. For all the reasons you said. It really changes up how it's played and makes that part very interesting. But then, like you said at the end, it always comes back down to waiting for you to get the right cards and then how to get them to the right people at the right time.
Oh, well.
And that was Pandemic Fall of Rome by Z-Man Games.
Played a game of Space Cadets Dice Duel. Space Cadets Dice Duel is probably my favorite game of the Engelstein clan. This was done by Jeff Engelstein and Sydney Engelstein. The core Space Cadets game I do not enjoy, but Space Cadets Dice Duel is a team-based competitive game of real-time dice rolling. It's a little bit like Artemis, if any of you have played the PC game Artemis, where everyone's divided up into stations. It's really quick and really vicious and really frenetic and head-to-head. The problem is, one of the difficulties with Space Cadets Dice Duel, on top of the fact that a lot of people don't like real-time games and don't like real-time team-based games like that because they find it too stressful. It's got a lot of rules grit, and that's one of the good things about it. The subsystems matter. The subsystems are detailed, and so what you can do and how to get there and the way the weapon systems work and how you acquire a target lock, they're not complicated, but they're detailed. And so, for one thing, the rules explanation needs to be very, very, very carefully done so that everybody can jump into the real-time element and not worry about the middle of the game and how it's functioning. So in a niche hobby, I find that Space Cadets Dice Duel is a super niche product, but I absolutely adore it, and it's great. I don't relish the prospect, as I almost always do in a game, of explaining to the weapons officer over and over again, it's like, well, you didn't hit this time because this happened, even when it's the case that it's because I'm bludgeoning them over and over again with the fact that they don't know what they're doing. Anyhow, this was further undercut by the fact that the rules explanation this time was not done by me, and it was relatively cursory, and so a lot of people didn't know what they were doing. But I really adore the game. In the right context, it's absolutely raucous fun. It scales really well from anywhere to 4 to 10 if you want to play it with the expansion Die Fighter, which is wonderful. And it's only going to last you about 30 to 45 minutes once you get going. So I highly recommend Dice Duel, even though it's not for every context. And I had a great time with it.
So we got a Kickstarter to the table that I wanted to pledge for, but in the end didn't. It's called Gentis. Now, the components are fantastic, and the gameplay is really good. A little of the deluxified parts, once again, made the game a little clunkier than it needed to be, right? They didn't actually improve gameplay, which is unfortunate, because it's nice when games like Crusaders or other games where the deluxified components are either not necessary or when they are introduced, they actually make the game better. And I'm very surprised that some of these games don't include the base components as well, so you don't have the choice of choosing which ones to use. But anyway, this is a fantastic, you know, multiple ways to victory, you know, purchasing cards, all that are going to work together to improve your engine. And, you know, you need to keep your money up, need to keep buying these cards and the way and manipulating, you know, how expensive, you know, certain citizens are going to be and waiting your turn, like seeing which cards you need and seeing, looking around the table, seeing which other people need those cards and see if you can wait until they're cheaper. Stuff like that. Very interesting gameplay, and I'm very much looking forward to playing it again.
I found Gentis to be relatively unengaging. I found the component issues, like you did, somewhat annoying. And it's basically just a worker placement game where you're just trying to churn out as many points as possible. The various elements of the game that are novel were very much oversold. Early press reports were praising the action selection to the sky, but it's basically just a worker placement system. And this whole issue, there's an issue of timing in Gentis where basically you either spend an extra action now or an extra action next turn, which is kind of cute. That part was kind of neat, and I haven't really played it enough to really see what the smart move is in most contexts, but mostly it seemed to be about buying and playing high point value cards, which is fine. It just didn't really do much for me. I'm going to play it some more because there might be some depth there, and it's not the kind of game where everything is transparent on first play, but in terms of the core systems, I didn't really see much of anything to grab me, and certainly nothing substantial that was novel. So
no, it definitely didn't bring, like, there was no hook or anything that was huge. The time element was kind of, I really liked how some actions, you know, used up more. But really, it's just like that will cost you more action points than, you know, when you really look at it. It's like,
exactly.
This thing costs more.
As I say, it's a worker placement game where some spaces cost 2 workers and some spaces cost 3 workers.
True. But it doesn't take much time, is what I thought. You know, it flowed fairly well. And even after rules explanation, I think we were done fairly quickly.
I was just hoping for something a little bit more novel, maybe a little bit more thematic, because I like civilization games or even games with a veneer of civilization, but it's pretty darn themeless, and it's pretty mechanical. It still could be engaging after that, but maybe I just need to manage my initial disappointment. And so that was my initial reaction of Gentis.
Well, I think if they penalized areas, you know, much like they do in Uwe Rosenberg games, if you don't concentrate on some areas, then you get penalized, like, because it seems though you could really concentrate on certain aspects of the game and just disregard others. And it would be interesting if they penalized you for disregarding those. And that way it would make it a more rounded game. Maybe, I don't know.
Strange to hear that from you. You're normally not a fan of such penalties.
In this particular game, I think it would benefit.
Well, much like Downfall, I think more to follow later.
Exactly.
And that was Gentis. Played another game of Roll for the Galaxy, which I bring up mostly because I've been reflecting on my views on all the sort of Thomas Lehman tableau builders lately, especially playing more Res Arcana and reflecting on how all the Galaxy products have been kind of evolving and moving forward with new frontiers and always new material available for Race for the Galaxy, which is great because I think that Race for the Galaxy remains the best tableau builder ever made. And now Roll for the Galaxy's got a new expansion, which I did not try, called Rivalry. We played with Ambition instead. And I bring it up in part because I was reminded why, when playing Roll for the Galaxy, why I like Roll for the Galaxy, but it is my least favorite of the Race for the Galaxy type products. And that is because in the other ones, primarily Race, you can get away without having a card influx engine. You can either exploit a military engine or do other things or just run your consume engine. But when it comes to Roll for the Galaxy, everybody needs to cycle their dice. It is a hard and fast requirement for everyone, no matter what you're doing, that your dice cycle at a good clip. And if you don't have that, you just can't get anywhere. And it really made the game feel less open to me when compared to other such games that Lehman himself has put out. And so while I like Roll for the Galaxy, I think it's solidifying its position for me as my least preferred version. I haven't heard you talk about Roll, because you played more Roll for the Galaxy than you have Race for the Galaxy, haven't you?
For sure.
What do you think about Roll for the Galaxy?
I'm not a fan. Like I said, I think the dice rolling becomes uninteresting very quickly in the game, where you can manipulate the dice to mean whatever you want them to, so rolling them seems kind of pointless after a while. It's like you can manipulate them, turn them, move them over here, you know, make them whatever you need them to be, so rolling them seems completely arbitrary at a certain point.
Well, it does make the game really noisy.
That's true. It also, you know, keeps the name of the game, you know, relevant.
You gotta get that branding in.
There you go.
So that was Roll for the Galaxy. Finally, got to play a game I've been looking forward to for a very long time, and that's Brook City. This is the latest output by Adam Sadler and Brady Sadler of Blacklist Games. They put out Street Masters that I just mentioned at the top of the show and we're big fans of here and So Very Wrong About Games. But my initial experiences with Brook City, I've now played it 3 times at various player counts and with various amounts of material stuffed in. It is a sort of elaboration of the system whereby in Street Masters you had these 3 decks, but mostly it was about beating the snot out of the boss or not getting the snot beaten out of you. So it was much similar to its progenitor, namely Sentinels of the Multiverse, which had the same victory and loss conditions, broadly speaking. Sometimes you get another loss condition, sometimes, but generally speaking, not. Brook City has complicated the system whereby now there's no standardized victory condition. You have your cops, and one loss condition is your cops can get fired. This is sort of an homage to 90s era cop movies and television shows of all types. You know, you've got your ripoff from the movie 7. You've got your ripoff from Lethal Weapon. You've got your ripoff from Fargo, for crying out loud. So they've cast a wide net. And I will point out, and this is worth noting, that the art for the Blacklist games has gotten much, much better at its representation of women. They're not just boob-heavy caricatures and sexualized objects. Everyone is still just a ripoff, though. They're all just homages to all existing characters, so that much hasn't changed. But I do give them credit for making a little bit of progress there. And similarly, their upcoming expansion to Street Masters, Aftershock, I haven't seen all the card art yet, but it looks a whole lot better, and it looks like it's continuing that trend. But in Brook City, there's no standardized victory condition. There's a victory condition introduced by each case you're running. So the environment deck, which is usually just background noise in a game of, say, Sentinels or Street Masters, is now how you win. It's the victory condition. And they've done some interesting things with the cases in terms of how they work. They all feel different. But the problem is, once you add in the details from the unique case decks and the details from the unique criminal decks, which introduce another loss condition, suddenly you've taken a system which was relatively simple but already had a fair bit of details to keep in mind and was very easy to play wrong, and I think they might have gone off the deep end. I think that Brook City might be a couple details too far, such that just running the system properly, just internalizing how to get to where you want to go, is a little bit too much cognitive load for its own good. The game doesn't get too complicated. It's just that once you have about 6 or 7 different cards spread out over the table with a wall of text that you need to internalize in order to just get a basic action done, or even to consider what basic action you want to do, at that point, you're ending up with something that's even harder to make decisions in than something like Mage Knight or some of your heavier Euros. And as a result, the games of Brook City that I played have been much too long. and more difficult to play than they needed to be. So I'm definitely not giving up. I like the Sadler Brothers a fair deal in terms of what they put out, and I'm hoping that maybe if I stick to more beginner cases for the earlier bits, some of the fans on BoardGameGeek have done yeoman's work in terms of identifying these are beginner, simpler cases and so forth. But even the simpler ones are pretty involved. So I'm hoping that I can get Brick City manageable. And if so, I'm gonna see what I can get out of the system. But most of the time now when playing Brick City, I wish I were playing Street Masters. And that's a bad sign for games of the system. And I'm wondering if the core system that the Sadlers quote-unquote invented, mostly by elaborating Sentinels of the Multiverse, was not designed to run a game this complicated. I'm actually reminded a little bit. The game that Greater Than Games put out right after Sentinels of the Multiverse was called Galactic Strike Force. And it was very similar to Sentinels of the Multiverse. Draw a card, do what it says it does. Just there were these status effects to be tracked all over the place. And the victory and loss conditions weren't straightforward and simple, like beating a boss and don't get knocked out. And some of the scenarios were aggressively dumb, and it was unplayable. Galactic Strike Force was pretty much unplayable, despite having a simple rule set. And I'm not saying that Brick City is that bad. Brick City is definitely better than Galactic Strike Force, but I'm worried if it's the same kind of trend and same kind of design problems. So more on that to follow. I'm going to be playing Brick City some more later. I'd love to hear what you have to say about it. And you love Street Masters, so I suspect your input would be valuable. But so far, it's looking a little shaky, and that's Brick City.
All right, now on to the news and why it doesn't matter.
So, ongoing now on Kickstarter, there is a game called Trick Shot. We've talked about that before. This is the newest game by Artem Nechepurov, designer of Warp Gate and Guards of Atlantis. This is his hockey game. I've played it a few times on Tabletopia and with the designer, so keep that in mind. But I have to say, even though it was playing online, and I'm very, very slow at playing PC games online, it's a very, very, very quick game. I've seen some concerns posted on BoardGameGeek. Is this going to be a quick game? Is this really as fast as it says? One of the design goals of Artem Nechepurov was to design a sort of very quick, very playable, very approachable equivalent to Blood Bowl, where spatial orientation mattered and where your positioning of your players was of key importance, but it didn't take 3 hours. A game of Trick Shot legit takes about 20 to 30 minutes. And I've had a lot of fun with it, and I do not enjoy the sports. I am not what you would call a sportsman, which is, I believe, how you say that word.
Totally.
But Trick Shot is fun. I pledged for it for what it's worth. So, you know, I'm obviously not getting anything on the back end. I paid for my copy. They're unlocking stretch goals as we speak. And I'm very impressed with what's been done with it visually in terms of the minis and everything else. So at least it's worth a shot. No pun intended. And that's Trick Shot by Wolf Designer.
Yeah, all my news is Kickstarter news because it seems pretty slow in the board gaming world. So we already talked about Bloodborne by Simon Games. I just took another quick glance at it, and I'm only talking about it because there's no dice. So that's kind of exciting. You don't make dice pools for a change.
That's true.
That's kind of exciting. I didn't really go in depth into the rules, but the fact that, like I said, there was no dice presence made me think that this might be something interesting. So now I'm going to have to see how combat is actually done to see if it's worth looking at. And that's Bloodborne by Simon Games.
So PAX Renaissance, another game I've been talking about in past weeks, is getting a reprint. Copies on the secondary market are going for a large quantity of money, especially the expansion, which is just a pack of 55 cards, typically sells for $100 or more. But a Spanish company has been in the works of the past few months doing a deluxe version with an actual map instead of just a bunch of cards that you lay out as a map and chess pieces that look like chess pieces. For those who haven't played PAX Renaissance, there are these lovely little bishops and lovely little knight pieces because everything in PAX Renaissance is equivalent to a chess piece, but the pawns and the rooks don't look like pawns or rooks. They're cubes and little cylinders, respectively. So I would very much like to see fancier chess pieces. I will regret the fact that it will have a larger box because the box for PAX Renaissance is this adorable twee little thing. But it has been confirmed that there's going to be an English version of a deluxe version of PAX Renaissance. Whether it's going to be the same as the Spanish version, although, you know, less Spanish, is uncertain at this point, but there is a reprint in sight. So for all of you who've been desperate to get your own get your hands on either PAX Renaissance or the expansion, there is no need to succumb to the secondary market unless you're exceptionally impatient. So that's PAX Renaissance Deluxe Edition. Also on the topic of reprints, there's Die Macher, the venerable Euro game about German politics, which, for those in the know who've been around BoardGameGeek since the beginning, it is game number one in the BoardGameGeek database. It's a really good game. It was, you know, a 3 to 4 hour Euro game before that was even conceivable. And now everything is a 3 to 4 hour Euro game. Well, at least everything designed by Vital Lacerda. And It's been out of print for a while. The only English edition was kind of weak sauce, but it is going to be reprinted in a limited edition run. And I've mentioned this before, but I wanted to mention a specific thing that happened on BoardGameGeek because it was simultaneously hilarious and heartwarming. Somebody posted a picture of the prototype board, and it was observed by a number of users that they didn't like it. And then the publisher himself showed up and said, well, what do you not like about the board? You know, this is a work in progress. We can make changes. And an eagle-eye user on BoardGameGeek pointed out that when viewed from the top, it was mostly pale, but there were sections of shaded in darkness on the board that made it look like a certain political symbol in Germany of the early 20th century. It was one of those things that once you see it, it couldn't be unseen, because I first saw the picture and it's like, oh yeah, that looks great. I played various different kinds of Demarker boards. I saw this board. I thought it looked fine. But the moment it was pointed out, it's like, oh yeah, that's totally a swastika, 100%. No, it's not actually a swastika. It just looked a bit like a swastika. And the publisher then showed up in the same thread and said, oh my gosh, you're right. This does, oh no, I can't unsee it anymore. So it was changed overnight like that as a result of feedback on BoardGameGeek. So that's my feel-good story online about constructive criticism and feedback resulting in a superior product. So look forward to the Demacher reprint later this year.
All right, my last bit of news is just more Kickstarter stuff. Cleopatra is now up on Kickstarter. We've talked about it as well. It's just the fact that it looks like they're doing a great job. They're going all out on it, just like the original version. It's going to be this giant, you know, pyramid with all sorts of bits. And the other odd part about it is that you can get it completely painted for $40.
Really?
Yeah, like one of the add-ons says painted set $40, and I don't know why you would not do that. For $40, I'm in for the painted. If I've never actually played Cleopatra, so I'm gonna go over the rules, and if it's something that I think I'd enjoy playing, then yeah, I'm in for the painted set for sure.
It's okay. Same thing is happening with Trickshot, for what it's worth. You can get painted minis on Trickshot for a $20 premium there.
Nice.
And painted minis might be coming back. You know, they were here for a while, the golden age of HeroScape, where painted minis were a thing. You know, Claustrophobia and HeroScape and a bunch of other games, you could have pre-painted minis. And then they went away for a long time, and now maybe they're coming back. That's great.
We can only hope.
Finally, a bit of news that I'm surprised you didn't mention. Scythe is coming out with a modular board under the aegis of things that people have been asking for a long time, but it's finally coming to pass. I'm exceptionally dubious because if my experience with the Rise of Fenris is any indication, it's that Scythe mostly works because of how focused and narrow it is. And the moment you start meddling around with random start setups or random power distributions or what have you, things start to seem very arbitrary very quickly. Like, for example, it is important that the factions that don't have speed but don't have Riverwalk are of a very particular geographical setup. They need to be very, very determinate in terms of how they're situated. But the moment you start messing with that, things get bizarre. And so I'm a little bit nervous about how they're going to be doing this, but I'm sure that Jamie Stegmaier thinks he knows what he's doing, and I'm sure everyone will love it. And you're probably going to get a copy anyway, right?
No.
No.
More on this later. I'll talk about something like this later.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to hearing it. So that's the news and why it doesn't matter. Onward to our topic, and this is one that I suggested. The topic is good games that induce pain, because sometimes when you're playing a game, it's just painful because it's bad, and either the company's bad or the game is bad, but it hurts so good.
It's true, but how about, let's just go right into it. Games,
sure.
Games that have too many expansions.
Sure.
So games like Mystic Veil or now Scythe or Carcassonne or oh my lord, Terraforming Mars, where you open the box and it's like the base was so good, yet remember having such good fun, but now you look at it and it's like, what do we play with? What do we add in? What was good? I don't remember. Close the box, grab something else. So games that are great, but that just when they try to drill it for too much money by bringing out all these expansions, it just becomes painful.
The painful, nostalgic impulse of remembering back when a game brought you joy and now it just brings you pain.
Now it just brings you pain.
Ah, that's too bad. So what you're saying is getting the Scythe modular board might bring Scythe over into that territory, is what you're
saying. I think it's already there.
Really?
With Fenris, yeah. When you open up now, it's all this stuff and it's just like, okay.
Well, but Fenris is so ignorable. You can just leave those to the side.
It's true. But I mean, it's the fact that it's there.
All right. Well, I'm sorry, man. That's too bad. any more positive experiences of...
What I have is all these things that make them painful and then examples. Okay, too long of a setup. And we already talked about a game, both games like this, which is Gloomhaven and Mage Knight. These games, both these games are fantastic, but the length of time it takes them to set up and tear down. Kingdom Death Monster is also one of these. It just makes it painful.
Well, Kingdom Death Monster is actually something that I wanted to talk about as well in terms of, you know, good games that induce pain, because I think, yes, there's the pain of setting up, and that's non-trivial, and there's the pain of all the paperwork, but the kind of exquisite suffering that I want to talk about, primarily in terms of something like Kingdom Death, is just the game punches you in the face repeatedly over and over and over again all the time. And that's its charm, right?
Yes.
Because there's lots of suffering involved in gaming, either because the game is bad or because it's an aspect of a game that you don't enjoy. But sometimes the pain is the good bits. And I don't think Kingdom Death would work if it weren't so painful, at least in that context.
No, you really need to get it into your head right away that you're not playing characters, that you're playing sets of gear, because your character's going to die. Do not get attached. These are Game of Thrones characters. They will soon be dead.
Sure.
Too long to play, like level 7, lots of other games.
Which level 7? Invasion or Omega Protocol?
Level 7 Invasion.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic, huge co-op game that plays very much like Pandemic, that has all these interesting abilities and powers and mechanisms and you know, upgradable things and everything that you'd want in a game, but it just takes too long to play.
I wish, actually, that Level 7 Invasion had more of this good kind of pain that I like. Because one of the things that I had against Level 7 Invasion is that I never really felt like I was in danger. It really was the case that we were able to just deal with all the alien threats. The only tool that the aliens seemed to have in their disposal was just showing up in a random place after you'd already deployed your troops. That didn't feel satisfying. I'd rather feel like there was this tremendous horde of aliens that I can't begin to deal with. I have to pick my spots and try to hold on, but...
Well, we were playing on entry level, so
fine.
They do have levels that you can play. So
okay,
we'll see.
Okay.
Next, I have is you always need to read the rules, reread the rules, or there's always that ambiguity. Sometimes you always have to sort of parse out the rules every time you play it. There's some games you just open the box, set up, you never even touch the rule book. But then there's always that one game, like Caverna, that has like a 4-page where you can put animals and how they work section that you always have to go over yet again to figure out how it works. And that's kind of painful when you have to reread the rules every time you play the game.
Well, that's basically the problem that I was trying to articulate with Brook City, because the rules themselves are fine, but the actual rules of the game consist largely of the different case and criminal sets that you have. And there, the information is spread out on these cards, and it's almost impossible to internalize everything, at least from my perspective. And so, yeah, there's a good game there. It's just the process of trying to get there was I was separated by too much painful management in order to get there. There are games where I think... Sometimes, though, the game seeks to make you suffer, and that's what we like about it, though. I'm thinking specifically of a couple of games we both like by Vladek Vadel, namely Galaxy Trucker and Space Alert, right? There, the pain is baked into the design.
Gotcha.
In Galaxy Trucker, yes, you've got a lot of the elements of the setup. You've got a lot of elements of a lot of components, and sometimes, maybe, yes, if you don't have enough discipline, you have that element of opening up and saying there are too many expansions here. But at least in Galaxy Trucker, you can use that to tailor the difficulty level for everybody. And then because the job of a good game of Galaxy Trucker is to make everyone suffer and see the fruits of all their labors blow up and disintegrate in a giant fireball of death. The same largely is true of Space Alert, where, a successful mission is satisfying, but, you do feel a little bit cheated if it's the case that you didn't get by the skin of your teeth.
Exactly. Oh, see, all my examples are actual real suffering to my personal body, where are baked into the game mechanics.
Well, yeah, because, you see, I wanted to focus on games that were still good despite the suffering, whereas
gotcha.
You wanted to, I think, emphasize, and this is a perfectly fine difference of focus, you wanted to emphasize games that could have been good if they didn't inspire pain, which is fine.
While you're talking there, led me to just Mage Knight. There's that one character that the more damage you take, the cooler she gets. So there's one example of an actual baked-in thing.
Yeah, skirting the line where you want to have lots of damage But you can't have too much. Yeah, a lot of characters have those where I was actually playing a character like that in Brook City, where the job is to accumulate enough damage so that you now become incredibly effective, but not too much damage because then you'll get knocked out.
So my next real pain is when players use the same strategy every time in a game. The game could be fantastic, like Great Western Trail, but you get into it again and the same players use the same strategy over and over again, and it's painful to play.
Why do you find that painful?
I just do. It's like because there's so much to explore. There's so many other things you can do to try to interact with, try to, you know, increase or, you know, do up differently, you know, try something different. And it's just, it's sad to see these guys just do the same thing every time.
Oh, that's too bad, because I worry then that you might get sick of playing things like Too Many Bones or Feast for Odin with me, because as I've said repeatedly, I love the fact that these games are wide open and you can choose any number of specializations and every different tactics, and I love the fact that those are open to me, and yet I always find myself doing the exact same thing, and I'm kind of okay with that. I've made my peace with that about myself, but that might drive you up the wall as a result.
Hardly any of my games are missing pieces. In fact, I can't think of any.
Oh, man.
That I'm missing pieces of. There's some that when I opened them up, they had wrong pieces and I got them replaced. But I have one game, Sid Meier's Civilization by Fantasy Flight, that somehow there was water damage done. I forget exactly how. I think someone spilled a drink or something.
Mm.
Some of the tokens got destroyed. So I know it's a game that has pieces that are missing. It's still playable and whatever, because it was like from a random draw of pieces, you know, you take it. But I know that some of them aren't there, and that kind of thing drives me crazy and causes me pain.
It's just the mere knowledge causes you some psychic damage.
Exactly.
Wow. So there's one game actually that I wanted to talk about, and I wanted to know if you had any experience with it. This is an old turn of the century Kiesling and Kramer design called Pueblo. Have you ever played it?
I might have. It doesn't ring a bell.
The great thing about Pueblo, I'll say this, I've never played Pueblo, but I've seen many games played. I will always happily watch people play Pueblo, but I've never played it myself, and here's why. It's one of those games where points are bad, and everything you do gives you points. I don't know if you've ever played a game like that before. Every move is torture. Everything, it's a game of pure schadenfreude. All that you do in the game is you try to minimize your own bleeding and try to make sure that everyone else suffers as badly as you do, which is weird because it's this cute little game about an overseer wandering around and looking at lovely, chunky wooden pieces that you use to build this massive structure in the middle of the board. But mostly the fact that every move is so unfortunate and there are no good turns, there are no good moves for you. A good move is where you don't suffer too badly. It's just so much delicious suffering, and it's still a quality design. It's those experiences that, you know, I absolutely have the same experiences you're talking about of, you know, contemplating my incomplete game or contemplating a game that is now too bloated for its own good. But sometimes there's a peculiar kind of pain that I actually really appreciate. And there's the one of Pueblo. There's also, this routinely happens, one of the most common things that I say while playing some games is, I am not a smart man, because I immediately observe that all my planning is for naught, and usually that's when I'm playing splatter games. Splatter games for me are, to a certain extent, the epitome of this delicious suffering. I'm thinking particularly of Antiquity. Not so much Food Chain Magnate, because usually in Food Chain Magnate, when I'm losing, I know who to blame. It's that person selling beer. And they ruined my day. But when I'm playing Antiquity, I know it's my own fault. When I look at the pollution that I've made and the graves that I've found and the fact that I don't have room now to build a second city and I'm never going to be able to build that cathedral again, I know it's my own fault. I feel like such a moron, and I love the game for making me suffer so. Are you familiar with that sensation?
I am. Where you just made the totally not optimal play and you just look down the table and you realize that you've ruined your own game.
But do you ever derive any satisfaction from it? It's a peculiar kind of sadism.
Yes, exactly. It's like, I've done it again.
Yeah.
I am awesome.
it's weird because I remember this was a design trend that to a certain extent is very much true of Splatter, and they've been doing this for a long time. But in terms of mainstream Euros, I associated as really starting with Agricola and having to feed your family and all that stuff. And there was a couple of years where it was very much the dominant design theme. I remember actually the turning point where I no longer thought that Stefan Feld was any good, and that was all the games he released after In the Year of the Dragon, because In the Year of the Dragon is very much the same thing. Everything is bad. I think there's pretty much only one action that you can do that's solidly good. The rest of it is just pain management. And I really liked In the Year of the Dragon. I also liked Notre Dame that he released before that. There you go. There's my French quota for the episode.
There you go. Good job.
you know, before he went into Point Salad, before he went into the standard Tracks on Tracks on Tracks, he could design some really tight Euro games, and one of them, which induced that beautiful kind of suffering, was in the Year of the Dragon. So I still have very fond memories of that game in particular.
All right, some real pain. When you're playing games that on your first play, it's impossible to do well, right? So that's painful. But when you've played it multiple times, or a few players at the table have played it multiple times, and you've brought in a new player and watching them struggle, that's very painful.
Yeah, especially if they're not able to. Some people love that. Again, on the just of general, you know, sadism and masochism, some people adore the fact that a game is kicking their butts and they think this demonstrates that there's a skill horizon. Which reminds me of another game that can be very, very painful, both in the sense of frustrating for new players and satisfying for experienced players, and that's Tigris and Euphrates. Most people that I speak to about Tigris and Euphrates, even though they love it, because any sane person does, it very often feels like you're losing the entire game. You know, very, very rarely is it the case that someone's like, yeah, I'm dominant, I'm crushing this. Most of the time it's like, ugh, everything is terrible. I can't get anywhere.
I need blue cubes.
I need points. Oh, this is awful, but everyone is feeling that way.
My example is Gaia Project. You know, people that have played it, you know, more than once, you know, flourish, whereas when it's your first play, you have, like, sometimes, depending on the player, of course, you have no idea what's going on and you get stomped. Next one I have is games that many enjoy because you know the mechanics are great, you understand why they like them, they enjoy it very much, and you know it's sound mechanics, but you hate it anyway. Like Spirit Island. I recognize Spirit Island is a great game.
Sure.
And everything else, but it is not for me, and I find it very painful to play.
When was the last time you had to play anyway?
Not for quite a while.
Yeah.
Thankfully.
Yeah, look, there are enough people that want to play Spirit Island desperately that, you know, no one's forcing you to do it.
Yeah,
so
I don't know what their problem is.
I don't know why you're complaining all the time about maybe the one or two times you played Spirit Island.
Because it's funny.
Okay. All right, fine.
How about games where you need a certain number of players and it's impossible to get that number?
That is so frustrating,
it's
yes.
It's like you've worked it out, you've invited this many people, but of course one person doesn't show up, or all the people show up, but one's brought a friend. Thank you for that. That's great, because now we can't play this game that I never get to play because we need exactly this many players.
That was one of the great things about organizing Mega Civ, which we should really do again, by the way. The great thing about Mega Civilization is the player count is so flexible. You know, if you're planning, we planned for, I think, 9 people to show up. A couple of people will drop out, fine. I don't even need to change the map. I just need to change a couple setup things. 5 people bring friends, no problem. That's fine. I mean, we would have run out of place in your home.
Yes.
But in terms of the game accommodating it, somebody showed up that didn't RSVP. Not a problem. Somebody had to leave early. Not a problem. It was great. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not able to play Space Cadets Dice Duel very often. You loathe the game. And any high player count game, especially ones that are divisive, that really emphasizes that kind of pain. Because if you get 6 people around a table, it's one of the reasons why I don't get to play Guards of Atlantis nearly as much as I like. Because the contexts in which we frequently get 6 together, one of them doesn't like Guards of Atlantis. And it's a very, you know, it's a very unique design, and so it's understandable that there are some people that don't enjoy it, but the more people you get around a table, the greater the odds of someone taking a miss, and so.
My example is Star Wars Rebellion. It's a 2-player game, pseudo 4, but really a 2-player game, and we just never, you know, when we have 2 players, we usually want something quick, nasty, deadly, whereas Rebellion is like a couple hour in-depth jaunt, and so it's very painful that I don't get to the table, you know, more than I do. Like, I got the expansion for it, like, years ago, and I've yet to play it with the expansion. So that is very unfortunate and painful.
For me, some of the most painful decisions that a game can inspire, specifically in the context of a game, is certain kinds of auctions can just be excruciating, either good or bad. Most recently, there was the game of the Estates that we played. And I read about session reports of people playing the Estates and ending with a winning score of 0. And I have no difficulty imagining that whatsoever because of how vicious and painful every bid is. There was a game called Before the Wind, which had similarly aggressive bids where you try to dump things off onto people that they can't deal with them. Stevenson's Rocket sometimes has those really, really painful moments of suffering where you have to force someone to no-win situation, although that's usually someone's deliberate play. Same thing with Chicago Express. Chicago Express is a brilliant auction game. But I remember in particular, in terms of just This is less of a good pain and more of just a painful pain. There was a two-player auction game called Medici versus Strozzi by Reiner Knizia. And Reiner Knizia, I love Reiner Knizia auction games, but there's one very strange feature of Medici versus Strozzi, and that is almost invariably you end up with less money than you started with. And this is a game about being merchants. And so it just felt so painful because you knew you were losing money hand over fist, even while you were winning. It's one of those weird things like the penny auction where you're doomed to lose money regardless of what happens. It's a bizarre situation, but I do appreciate games that put you in those strange situations.
All right, my last one is when games get played too often, it starts to get a little painful. Like our one group that we go to was playing Terraforming Mars over and over again, and it just seemed, after a while, it seemed as though it was getting painful to play. It's like, okay, there's so many other games. Why don't we just play something else for a change? Can we please stop playing Terraforming Mars? I'm not saying it's just Terraforming. Any games, if you play them.
Are you trying to troll me?
Yes.
Okay.
100%.
I'm not going to take the bait. I'm not going to feed the troll.
So the other thing I was thinking about, I don't want to, it's, maybe I sound conceited, but when you see there's an actual game mechanic flaw or there's something that would make the game 100% better if they just did that, and it's almost always graduated decks. And so I always look at it. It's like they have this giant thing, and it's like, okay, we're cycling through this. Why didn't they graduate that? Why didn't they slowly make it harder? Why am I drawing this giant monster at the beginning? Why didn't they just put that at the bottom? Why didn't they graduate that deck? It was so easy to do. Why didn't they do it? That's painful.
It must be painful to know so much better than everyone around you, Walker.
Exactly. It's very painful to be a better game designer than all the other game designers out there when I haven't even designed a single game. So that's painful to me.
But you deal with it so well and you never complain.
It's so true. You know, I'm just modest that way, I guess.
So that's going to do it for this week. Thank you very much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach Walker via his email, justrolledadice@gmail.com. You can reach me, Mark Bigney, on Twitter @TheGamesYouLike. For more public discussion, you can find the So Very Wrong About Games Facebook page, or you can check out our Board Game Geek Guild, which is guild number 3236, and you can find us on Patreon. We read everything you send us, and we'll get back to you if we can. Thanks again for tuning in, and we hope to see you again soon.
Next week.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bigney. Special thanks goes to What Does It Eat for generously allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our theme. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. You can reach us by email at soverywrongaboutgames@gmail.com or on Twitter @SoWrongGames. Thanks very much, see you next time, and always, try to be right, but remember you are so very wrong.